Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. And you're listening to New Books in American Politics. Today I'm speaking with Patrick J. Charles about his new book, Vote Gun, How Gun Rights Became Politicized in the United States. Patrick is senior historian and archivist for the United States Air Force. Vote Gun examines how gun rights activism has been transformed over the past century. Especially in the last half century, gun rights have become a key wedge issue that helps explain our ongoing political schism. Patrick deftly outlines how the pro-gun vote and the gun control vote respectively define American politics and culture. One quick note before we begin. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Air Force, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Patrick, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you, Caleb.
Of course. Before jumping into the book, I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Yes. I've been with the Air Force for going on 13 years now as a historian and archivist in different capacities. I've spent most of my time working for different special operations units within the Air Force. Currently, I serve as the research division supervisor at the Air Force Historical Research Agency. Basically, what I do is I lead a team of archivists in safeguarding and researching United States Air Force repository. Just prior to assuming this position, I was what was known as a legislative fellow for the Air Force. So I got to spend 3 years on Capitol Hill doing work for the Air Force in their capacity. And in the process, learned a great deal about the political workings on Congress, which were beneficial to me writing this book. It was quite a timely assignment, I would say.
And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about, you know, some of the things that led to the writing of this book. Was there any particular conversation, document, or event that made you think that this is a book that needs to be written?
Honestly, this was not a book I think I would ever write. I've been writing about the Second Amendment going back to 2009, 2010-ish is when I started getting really deep into the Second Amendment. And the more I researched, the more I wanted to know is how did we kind of get to where the position we are at today, where we're so divided, where even we can't even have a discussion about history without it raising huge disagreements and red flags between people. So in 2014, while I was pursuing my LLM at Queen Mary University in London, I had to write two dissertations, and one of them I decided to write on this topic, which was basically what I call the Second Amendment in the 21st century, and just trying to understand, you know, the political talking points, you know, why people have taken sides, why did Republicans overwhelmingly support gun rights and why did Democrats overwhelmingly support gun control? Obviously, neither party is a monolith completely, but the more we have progressed, the more that divide has been increasing, those gaps, so much so that, I mean, it's really hard to find moderates on either side of the aisle in this. So when I was writing my book, which preceded this was Armed in America, and it published in 2018, that my original idea in researching all this, because a lot of it coincided, was to basically do a macro history on the politics of gun rights and gun control and where we're at today, you know, going through the 2016 election between Donald J. Trump and Hillary Rodham Clinton. But I just kept finding more and more information that led me to believe that to do such a book would be thousands of pages. And more importantly, there was a story of the early to mid 20th century that hadn't really been told to the detail that it needed to be told. People had skipped over it. Also, there was this ongoing myth that the NRA, as we know it today, which fights against most gun controls, I would say basically all gun control, but you know, was born in the late 1970s for this viewpoint of being more of a Second Amendment absolutist. But it turns out in my research, and the more I came to find out, is that that was completely untrue, that the NRA, you know, going back to the 1920s, was adamantly against most gun controls. And much of what we know about the NRA, that it was a supporter of moderate gun controls, which a lot of scholars had said prior to me writing my book, is that it was patently false. It was actually propaganda that the NRA had put out to try to continue to politically straddle both sides and benefit greatly politically from its opposition to gun control on one side, but at the same time, getting support from gun rights supporters and firearms owners saying, hey, we're an ardent defender of the Second Amendment. But, you know, we'll get into that. But, you know, there basically became an inflection point where the NRA could no longer politically straddle both sides, and it had to choose one or the other, and then choosing being, you know, adamantly against gun control.
So I was wondering if you could, you know, sort of picking up on that, talk a little bit about the history of gun control leading up to the 60s. And then once we, you know, we'll get more into the specifics of some of the debates around the 60s and the 70s. But what did that sort of prehistory look like? You already hinted at a little bit with the NRA's positions in the 20s.
Yes, I'll just start at the turn of the 20th century, because I think, you know, we don't want to go too far. Heck, but yeah, the turn of the 20th century, the idea that we have today of that gun control is like a state-driven, or gun rights are state-driven, or even federally driven, like a national right, was non-existent. It was firearms regulations were highly localized. You can go from one city to the other in the same state and have completely different gun controls. Let's say you're traveling from Missouri all the way to California, same thing. You would run into a myriad of different laws along the way, and no one really batted an eyelash at this until about, you know, the late 1910s. A group called the United States Revolver Association came about, and they were already they're already around, they were already established, but they came about politically. And they came about because in 1911, New York adopted what's called the Sullivan Law. And that law was one of the first, not the first, but one of the first state laws to require a permit to purchase a pistol. I believe Minneapolis was the other city that enacted, and Chicago may have enacted one as well. So there was huge political upswell for firearms owners that did not want this law to spread to other states. They thought it was an abomination and an affront to the Second Amendment. And they did anything and everything they could to lambaste it and say that it was, you know, wrongheaded against the Second Amendment and so forth. So USRA comes up with this idea, the United States Revolver Association. They say, well, let's come up with some model legislation, what we call sane and reasonable legislation. And if you actually read their legislation today, you'd say, wow, they're pretty firm supporters of gun control. And in many ways, they were. I mean, this legislation supported things like background checks, waiting periods, and, you know, requiring a permit to carry a pistol, and not a shall issue as we know it today, but as may issue, is that, you know, it was a discretionary permit based on local licensing authorities. The idea behind this law of it being model was that they principally just wanted to stop the myriad of rules that could entrap a sportsman. Like if a sportsman was traveling from Illinois to Indiana, he'd be subject to different gun laws. And if he got caught doing a different gun law, you know, he'd be in legal trouble. And this was to kind of get rid of that. No one really takes the USRA up on their offer. Just a very few states consider it. It's not until the 1920s that the NRA gets involved that you find it to spread. And the NRA basically adopts USRA's model legislation wholesale. And that's because Carl Frederick, who was an officer of both organizations, and again, they were able to basically just take this legislation and run with it. I think at the end, they may have gotten, I haven't done a really good tally, but at most 40% of the states adopted some form of what they called the Uniform Firearms Act at the time. that basically, again, established these model laws. After that, well, let me backtrack a little bit. Those model laws were basically a springboard into what would become federal legislation. And the reason the federal legislation comes about is because a lot of gangsters and underground criminals are able to thwart state firearms laws by going from one state to another. The pursuance of federal law to address this problem is taken up. However, almost immediately, as soon as the federal government takes it up, the NRA is adamantly opposed to it. They start putting in their magazine, the American Rifleman, that they did not want it to go forward and for its members to write against it. As time goes on, they decide to kind of come aboard on it, but only if they can write the legislation. And they effectively do that. They basically get the opportunity to draft the bill and get it forward. And they say to the public, or to their constituents, firearms owners, and say, you know, this is a great bill. Get it back, and they back, and it gets passed. But the bill really doesn't do anything to stop law-abiding or a reasonable person from accessing firearms. It really was only geared towards gangsters. And with that said, I mean, firearms fatalities continue to happen all across the country. And the federal government wants to do more. And they think, well, the best way to do this is if we pass a law registering pistols, perhaps long guns. But they really want to go after pistols because more than 3/4 of all firearms-related deaths in the 1920s and 1930s are due to pistols. So they're hoping to get the NRA on board with this. The NRA is opposed to it. It is a long, drawn-out process of roughly 3.5 years of fighting between the Department of Justice and the NRA. And in the end, the NRA wins, convinces Senator Royal Copeland of New York that it was in the government's best interest if they draft the legislation, which they did. And their legislation goes forward, and there was actually a provision in that legislation that would have negated the National Firearms Act, but for the Department of Justice pointing to the committee and saying, hey, we need to remove that provision. It may have stayed in, and the 1934 bill may have been nullified, but that's how you get the 1938 Federal Firearms Act. And then after that, really, the National Rifle Association has a monopoly on all firearms laws across the country at the state and local level. Yes, there are a few exceptions to the rule where some local governments were able to pass restrictive laws, but more or less the NRA, through its system of rousing sportsmen, firearms owners and hunters to rail against firearms laws, nothing significant was enacted without the NRA's express approval.
And were there supporters of the leadership partial to one party versus another at this point in time?
Yeah. At that time, I mean, up and through the early 1960s, there was no partisan nature to gun control and gun rights. Whether or not one was to support gun rights or gun control had nothing to do with political party whatsoever. There was more or less a rural and urban divide. If you have a rural lawmaker, they were more or less willing to support gun rights over gun control, and vice versa if you had an urban lawmaker. But really, if you look at their opinions on this, you see there are two things. It's either they're very ill-informed of the issue because it's not something that's making it to their desk, or they're basically just parroting whatever the NRA supporters are writing to them or the NRA has sent to them and discussed with them as talking points. They're not very nuanced. They're not particularly well thought out. In fact, my perusal of lawmakers' opinions, especially on the Second Amendment, has shown they really did not have a very good understanding of its history and its left and right parameters. They basically would just say, you know, I support it or I interpret it as this and have nothing to back it up. It was a quick one-off, one or two sentences about it, and that was it.
So yeah, moving a little bit further ahead in time, if you could discuss the impact of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, what impact that had on the gun lobby and just the general debate around guns in the country?
If I recall correctly, it was either the day before or not long before. It's in the book. And in New York, the gun rights advocates were about to undo several of, or at least lobbying to undo several restrictive New York gun laws. what ends up happening is after JFK is assassinated, that completely flips on its head, and a number of gun control bills are put forward, and I think only two pass, but the attitude in the country quickly goes pro-gun control. And at this time, investigative reporting is really starting to take off. And what investigative reporters are quickly learning is that the reason that America was known for being, I think to quote Ted Kennedy, was first in deaths and last in gun controls, is that the NRA was responsible for undoing or defeating or stalling most gun control bills. They were able to do this before they even got to the committee and kill them through letter writing campaigns. So, you know, investigative reports kept digging and digging and digging. And the NRA was basically outed as what, you know, they would call the gun lobby. Now, the NRA adamantly opposed this label. They were not the gun lobby. They were not paid by gun manufacturers per se. And they made every argument against it. However, if you actually look at their literature going up through the 1940s, they held themselves out to be the gun lobby. And they would often brag about their ability to defeat gun control legislation if they so chose to do so. And then lastly, they had a lot of congressional surrogates in place that they could relay information, bills that they would then submit or talk to their fellow colleagues about what to and what to not support. Did the NRA at that time pay anybody on Capitol Hill or lawmakers to do X, Y, or Z? No. That's not what was going on back then. It was really more or less about, you know, political self-preservation. Is this the right side of the issue I need to be on to be reelected? So when Kennedy is assassinated, the NRA has to kind of deal with this new image. They wanted to maintain the image of what they were, which is basically a preeminent patriotic organization in the United States. And, you know, they had letters from presidents and generals saying what a great organization they were. However, what the NRA often left out, I mean, always left out, let's put it that way, is that the NRA actually wrote those letters. I mean, they would send those letters to the lawmakers, the presidents, or the generals and say, can you sign this for us? And then they would publish it in their magazines and look what great things they're saying about us. So that was left out. So the crosshairs was on the NRA. Now all the criticism of the NRA was warranted, I want to say. There were things the NRA is being blamed for that were completely out of their control or they had nothing to do with. For instance, some people would call the NRA extremist organization or say that they supported extremists, but the NRA actually had a bylaw, but you had to basically take an oath of allegiance to join the NRA, and then that oath you denounced any extremist organizations you agree to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. So the NRA was not that at that time, at least. I mean, they've become more extremist today, obviously, but not them. They wanted that patriotic label on them that they had earned, especially after World War II.
From 63 to 68, what were politicians and political leaders' views on gun control at the time?
Well, I think in 1963, because so many lawmakers had put forward different gun control proposals, lawmakers had to get quickly spun up on this issue. Obviously, their staffs would educate them and so forth on the bills and issues. So I think that's one big change that happens right away out of this. With that said, it really does not move the needle all that much because the talking points put out by gun rights advocates had no gun control counterpoint. There was no organized gun control opposition at that time. Yes, the NRA and other gun rights advocates would often tell their supporters, I mean, even going back to the 1920s and say, well, there's this organized effort, gun control supporters that are secretly influencing politicians and trying to take away your guns. There was no such effort. It was all made up. It's in fact, not until 1968, the Emergency Committee for Gun Control, that you have your first really organized gun control or opposition to the NRA. So the NRA is basically able to put out talking points with no pushback, and that was effectively able to stall gun control legislation, even though, you know, it was on the minds of many. And ultimately, after Kennedy, I mean, again, the spotlight was on the NRA, and they knew it. And what they did to their advantage is they would often put out information saying, well, you know, we support reasonable gun control. but this is what we think is reasonable. And their definition of reasonable was really nothing. It was bare bones, wouldn't really stop anybody from getting access to a gun. But they would say, you know, the real enemy of the state is the people that are pushing for firm gun control because they're trying to take guns away. We're trying to find that moderate ground, try to work with us. So they kept trying to do that political straddling approach that had worked so well for them going up through the 1950s. And it effectively worked until the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And things quickly got off the rails. Members, at least in the federal government, members of Congress knew something had to be done. And that's where you see the first gun control bill passed the federal level in 30 years, at least restrictive gun control bill. And then, you know, Senator Robert Kennedy is assassinated not long thereafter. And then we see another. And I think we can go into stop right there for right now. But, that's really the big turning point is when Senator Kennedy is assassinated that, this issue becomes seriously hot.
Right. So picking up on that, then how the gun vote shaped the 1968 American election.
Yeah, I think even before Kennedy, Senator Robert Kennedy was assassinated, there was discussions that gun control could become a 1968 election issue. But after Martin Luther King Jr. died and was assassinated and the first gun control law was passed, and then Robert Kennedy was assassinated, it quickly got elevated up. You start to see, and this wasn't immediate, I want to say for the first week to 10 days after Senator Kennedy was assassinated, everybody was on board, a good strong majority, both the Senate and the House, with doing something on gun control. In fact, the letter writing campaigns were overwhelmingly 8 or 10 to 1 in jurisdictions in support of Congress passing strict gun control. But we all know that Congress cannot act usually that quickly unless something's already in the hopper, and things were forced to sit, and politicians were given more time to consider, and they went into recess. So that gave time for the gun rights advocates to come back and institute their own letter writing campaign and basically sway politicians back to opposing strict gun controls. Mike Mansfield, the Montana Senate majority leader, is a great example of somebody who, right after Kennedy's assassinated, he comes out in support of firearms registration, but within a matter of weeks, realizing that what was happening, he changes his vote, doesn't vote for firearms registration anymore. And there are dozens of examples in that. But the big thing that happens then is that for the first time in American history, the Democratic and Republican Party platforms have a position on gun control and gun rights, at least for the Republican Party, because the Republican Party at least recognizes some form of a right to a gun. And it's not just there. You start to see governors' conferences, state party platforms, you name it, anything that involves politics, gun control became an issue. It was a talking point. It was seen as a wedge voting issue that which people could significantly benefit from. If your opponent supported gun control, you may want to support gun rights just to have a wedge voting issue. But in many jurisdictions, it was a non-issue. You know, both would be strong gun rights or both would be strong gun control. But you would see if it was a issue like what we would call now like a purple district, that if your opponent was for gun rights, you're like, well, you know what, I think I'm going to be for gun control. I have to find those voters. But at that time, what's interesting is that the demographics of these voters and their real impact on the election was completely unknown. Nobody knew what their impact was. Nobody knew if they could swing or sway an election. It's just people jumped on something that was divisive to the country to get, hopefully, grab the attention of those one issue voters.
So when exactly do you think, or can you pinpoint the gun rights lobby starting to radicalize a little bit, or at least push into more of a politicized, I don't necessarily like, you know, becoming more politicized as opposed to being just a issue that people on one side of the aisle or the other could take up?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Following the Gun Control Act, you start to see the rise of what I refer to in the book as the No Compromise movement. And the No Compromise movement basically took the position that they would no longer compromise on any gun control bill. So if you have a bill and it had a lot of gun control provisions, you could you know, in the past, maybe come back and say, let's lessen a couple of them, but we'll go with that. And maybe there's kind of a moderate middle ground. But this no compromise movement basically is pigeons like, no, you don't compromise on anything, everything you oppose, any and everything. And they use the NRA's talking points to make this argument. So the NRA basically had these talking points already in place, but they are, you know, going after circa 1968. They're technically moderates because extremist gun rights organizations are starting to form, especially at the local and state level. They are questioning the NRA's model for opposing gun control. They're also wondering why the NRA is not putting money into politicians or paying for campaigns, which the NRA could not have time given their status. And everything is getting called into question. So you got that going on, right? And you got the NRA is suffering and trying to find its balance, and is trying to still court those gun rights extremists while at the same time trying to promote a moderate message. In fact, there's memorandum that I found that would say, you know, or letters that they would say, you know, the NRA will never become a partisan organization. It would be detrimental to us to ever become aligned with one party or the other. But they quickly start to see that things are going far to the right. Nixon in 68 was taking a gun rights platform. And in fact, before him, Goldwater had as the Republican nominee. So Republican Party was shifting towards gun rights. And at the same time, the Democratic Party nationally was switching towards gun control. Now, again, neither was a monolith. There was no Republicans supported this and Democrats supported that. But the national party politics were leaning that way, which would then, you know, when you're talking about presidential elections, would lead groups like the NRA to support Nixon and other Republicans. Eventually, what ends up happening is the NRA keeps getting pushed to the right and to the right and to the right towards the no compromise movement. That they got there in 1977, but not without them trying to pivot. They tried to pivot and basically stand up a lobbying organization within the NRA that was going to be standalone on its own from the NRA and the NRA Shooting Center West. And a former NRA official known as Harlan Carter, who was ousted by the NRA after losing the 1976 election, Ford lost the 1976 election to Carter, ended up having to be forced to resign as well as his followers. And he ends up putting these talking points out in a way to convince NRA members to reform the NRA and take it over, which they do. And then that's how the NRA formally becomes radicalized. Although there's an argument to be made, it was always radicalized within and they made the situation, they created the situation that they got into, let's put it that way.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Do you think that part of the reason why, you know, maybe Democrats started to embrace gun control was just because of the sort of historical accident that three of their major leaders were killed by gun violence? You know, to what extent do you see the radicalization of towards the right of gun control, gun rights moving just because of that, like that sort of historical, those historical accidents of the three assassinations of JFK, RFK, and MLK?
That's an interesting take. I never thought of that before, but I don't think that necessarily had to do with it. They were the majorities. So they own the Gun Control Act, right? So when they passed those gun control laws in 1968, those were owned by the Democrats. And you can't pass that type of legislation and then go back and say, well, we oppose it and want to completely repeal it. Now, some Democrats did. Some Democrats completely flipped and thought, hey, after 1968, they think that firearms owners are an important voting contingent, and they completely flip on the Democratic Party and say, you know, we want to undo a lot of these provisions or maybe even repeal the whole Gun Control Act altogether. But the leadership in the Democratic Party knew that they really couldn't do that. It would look bad on them. Senator Mansfield is a great example of that. He didn't completely change his approach, but he was willing to adopt a few, or push forward a few laws that would undo the quote unquote burdensome restrictions that the NRA pointed out. But yeah, I just think it kind of just was something that, you know, the 68 cement election and 68 gun control kind of cemented, right? And then Nixon went law and order. And then Democrats also more or less held most of the city. So the shoe kind of fit, if you want to say, for both parties, and it kind of grew from there.
So can you summarize where the battle lines were by 1980?
By 1980, you know, nothing still has cemented. I can say nationally, obviously the Republicans are the party for gun rights from their platform. We know that to be true. And but at the same time, let's say this. In 76, President Carter, when he ran, he put forward several talking points and messages to try to urge firearms owners to vote for him, saying, you know, well, hey, I'm a firearms owner. I'm a sportsman. I understand guns. I like hunting. I will only, you know, he supported handgun registration. He said, that's where I would stop, handgun registration. He tried to get him to vote on this side. So it kind of shows that the Democrat, someone like Carter, was also thinking about this vote as well. But they could never really shake after that because the NRA had already gone Republican. And come 1980, Reagan, who had been an ardent defender of gun rights since his time as governor of California, was the presidential nominee, and he ultimately wins the election. And he comes out with a unapologetic support for gun rights. So when he wins in a landslide in 1980, the gun rights advocates, and let's be honest, many people in the press and the nation, I mean, writers are writing about this, and they start to see the firearms owner and the sportsman bloc, or whatever you want to call it, as a powerful voting contingent. So that really aligns the Republican Party with it. And everybody after Reagan has kind of kept going more and more towards gun rights. You know, I did something, I forget the numbers, in my 2014 article where it showed in Florida how, you know, in a 6 to 8 year span, how few Democrats had supported gun rights over gun control. But over that span, basically there was zero Democrats within the 10 year period. You know, with a decade, it was over. So now we're at the point now that you have very few people like, you know, Joe Manchin, who I think would be a moderate on this, right? There's not many of him left.
Or Bernie Sanders.
Correct.
Yeah. The book ends with Reagan. And, you know, you said at the outset that part of what inspired you to write this book was to just understand the current debate. And, you know, I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about, when you're looking at the present day debate, if there's anything that you think, you know, either side could learn from the past about how to maybe have a more effective conversation so that we can, not have this, you know, this kind of just insane conflict that just breeds utter hatred around firearms.
I think, I don't know if this answers your question. Here's what I will say about what this history kind of speaks to me, is that if you go back and if you really read the book, you read the talking points and the arguments for or against gun rights or for or against gun control, the needle has not moved all that much. We the same arguments that were being made in the 1911s and 1920s and 30s are still being made today. And that's kind of sad to me to think that we have not really evolved on this, that people retreat to their respective talking points or their positions, and they haven't moved when a bit. When I think what needs to happen really is, you know, you need to have more honest conversations with your gun control support. You need to talk to someone's gun rights, and vice versa. I know I have those conversations when I go to conferences or speak to people, or even when people find out what I do. We have those conversations, and they need to be had, because where we're at today is that you have one party who's just so adamantly for gun rights that they will rubber stamp anything and everything, whether it's removing restrictions on carrying guns in bars while you're drinking, restrictions on blind people carrying guns, removing training requirements, you name it, like things that to me, and for a long time, just common sense, or, you know, something like a background check, right? Polls show 90% of people support background checks of some form. Well, how does that 10% decide for the rest of us that we can have that? And the reason that 10% decides is because it's become politicized to the point that you have a whole party that's against it and one party that's supporting it. So instead of the 90% being listened to, you have a party that's opposing it adamantly. And the NRA could not see the benefit of that, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, but today they realize it. And that division party politics has really prevented us from making the needed reforms that we need to make, or even stopping new laws that have removed restrictions and had made access to firearms easier and more firearms in more places. In my opinion, we've already crossed the tipping point. You've created basically a perfect storm for the societal problem we're at today with gun violence. So hopefully by reading this, you can kind of, a reader will understand how we got to where we're at today and maybe make a decision for themselves. Well, how do I fix it? How do I have those conversations with my friends and family, my loved ones, or even with my representatives to say, you know, you've been saying this for, not, you know, 100 years, it hasn't come true, or you're saying this for 100 years and look where we're at today. You know, what has more guns really gotten us? Are we really safer? Are we in a better place? And I mean, I'm not saying that there's not a place for gun rights. I think there is. And I'm not saying that we need to have unduly burdensome gun controls. But I do think there's a moderate middle ground that we could do. But it'll ultimately take having those conversations.
No, I think that's a really a great point. And I do think that, you know, that the history that you dig into is useful, just because, you know, it's always good to go back and see, you know, at what point in time was the debate different? Were the people on one side or the other not the ones that as they appear today? Mm-hmm. You know, with this project out, I'm wondering, you know, this is obviously a topic that riles a lot of people up. And I'm wondering, you know, if there's any interesting response you've gotten, or, you know, since you've published it, different ways that you've thought about or been surprised about how people have talked about gun rights and the gun lobby.
I haven't gotten much feedback in that regard. All the feedback I've gotten is, you know, it's a very well researched book, and they're learning things that they had no idea about. And I think it's so early on that those that have read it are still digesting it, and they're still trying to, like, well, what does this all mean? Like, or how do we fix it? Certainly the book tells the story of how we got to where we're at today. And I think, again, I don't think it's my place to say where we should be unilaterally, but my hope is that we at least have those discussions. And I could tell you that the feedback I've gotten is people are starting to think more about this. Just politically, I mean, the as the book points out is, you know, this whole idea of the sportsman, what they call back then the sportsman voting bloc, or you know, firearms owner voting people out. You know, I think Clinton was one that once said that, you know, that's who responsible for flipping Congress one year. It's really all a myth. I mean, we're so gerrymandered to the point right now, it doesn't, the firearm block doesn't matter. Firearms owner block doesn't matter except for Republican primaries. That's it. I mean, that's the impact that they have. But until we've got to this point where we're at with gerrymandering, I would say they really had little to no impact. Once you start digging into the evidence, as I do in my book, about people that allegedly the gun lobby defeated, that's not why they lost, because it doesn't make sense when you compare it to other metrics and you start analyzing the data. So, yeah, I mean, we're at a point, and the only way this is going to change, and I'm probably saying the same with the Democrats and certain gun control provisions, is that we're going to have those hard conversations again, that you got people that are retreating to their corners for the primaries to get that primary election, because, you know, they're gerrymandered to the point that once they get past that primary, they're pretty much in. So when they face their opponent, yeah, hope that answers somewhat the question.
Yeah, absolutely.
The only way the needle has ever moved on any gun control legislation is if a national tragedy puts a spotlight on it and people start talking. Problem is that you only have such a small window to act, because the next tragedy will happen or world problem that moves it to something else. So you have a very small window. This is where gun rights is has the overwhelming advantage, because, you know, they've worked so systematically at the state level to undo these restrictions and then sue in the courts to get other restrictions undone. It's been quite fascinating and I would say depressing in a way to watch, because, you know, it's not a fair fight in any way, because once you undo something, if I restriction in place and I undo it, it's much harder to ever put that back in place. That's just how history of the law has always worked. When you give people more freedom to do something, when you try to take it away, it causes a lot of anger. And I think you saw that recently with what's happened with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, is that you have a groundswell of anger among women and particularly that are not happy with that decision, and understandably so. I think it was wrong as a matter of both law to overturn it, and I think it's wrong politically to not give women that voice to make that decision, but that's just me.
Well, Patrick, thank you so much for being guest of the New Books Network. I think that, you know, this is a really important book, especially, you know, for the current moment. I highly recommend people go out and check out Vote Gun, because, you know, it really just does add that history that is just missing from this debate. And I think that, you know, obviously people always talk about Second Amendment and what did the founders mean and all these things like that. But it's good to also deal with the more recent history of gun rights too, because it really just shows how, you know, the current state that we're in is just not necessarily what the main way of thinking has always been for Republicans or for Democrats or liberals or for conservatives. So I do recommend it for that. So thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Caleb.